We go. Anywhere you like. Anywhere?
My back was pressed against the door, and Kashmir was pressed against me, the portfolio sandwiched between us, one of its corners jabbing my thigh. Slowly he lifted his hand away from my mouth. There was frustration in his eyes, and it made me furious. I responded by lifting the portfolio and raising my brows, but he only shook his head. Then he stepped back from me on quiet cat feet and picked up a roll of paper leaning against the side of a blue upholstered chaise, giving it a little shake. The map. I ground my teeth and leaned the empty portfolio against the wall. When did you? He put his finger to his lips. Then he beckoned me to step away from the door, but I took one step and his hand flew up again. He pointed down near my feet. The hem of my new dress was caught in the door. I grabbed a handful of the fabric to pull, but Kashmir's frantic gesture stopped me. He handed me the map and reached up over his shoulder, drawing a short knife out from under his collar. Mr. Hart was speaking again.
But there is one more thing you must do for me. If I can, the captain said. If you cannot, there is no hope elsewhere. What is it? Well?
Slate's impatience was palpable.
They say, you and your crew have access to all manner of strange and mystical items, and it is, I am not proud to say it, but I require.
The pause was so long, I wondered if they'd left the room. But finally, Mr. Hart continued,
I require a love potion.
So Mr. Hart knew, too. Not only about our ship, but about Mrs. Hart. What would Slate say? I had asked him about love potions once, and he'd scoffed at the notion, disgusted by the very idea of forcing someone to fall in love. Still, mythology is rife with potions, powders, Cupid's arrows. Love as something taken rather than something given. I pressed my lips together. Kashmir was still flushed with anger. Or was it shame? He avoided my eyes. His knife whispered through the silk.
It would mean the world to me, sir, Mr. Hart continued. You understand. You told me why you want the map. You know what a man will do for love. Fine, Slate said at last. Yes, as I've said, I am not the expert. But Nix will find one. She can find anything. Ah, excellent, excellent.
Cash stepped back. I was free of the door. I handed him the map and made a shooing motion, but he looked at me quizzically. The captain, I mouthed, nodding back toward the door. My plan was simple. Barge in, tell the captain I had a message from B to return to the ship immediately, and whisk him out of the room before Mr. Hart could object. But I couldn't explain it all to Kashmir, who shook his head and gestured for me to follow him.
I can be found at the dock as soon as you're ready to leave, Slate was saying. The sooner the better. I would hate for your colleagues to have time to suspect anything. Perhaps even tonight after the ball. I will need time to pack and to put my affairs in order. Oh, what am I saying?
Mr. Hart's voice was elated, thrumming with impending freedom.
It's a new life. I needn't bring a thing. Except for the map, Slate said. Yes, the map. The map.
I met Kashmir's wide eyes. Go, I whispered, but he put his finger to my lips. Then he took me by the wrist and pulled me toward the door. It opened as we approached. There, silhouetted in the light from the hall, stood Blake. We froze, all of us, as he took in the scene. Kashmir hauling on my arm, my torn dress. Everything was still for one long, dreadful moment. And then Blake rushed toward us, shoving Kashmir.
Release her!
Kashmir stumbled against the chaise, dropping the map, which I grabbed up reflexively, pulling it away from Blake's trampling feet. I flung out my hand between them as Kashmir bounced back upright. Blake, it's not what... But Blake bulled forward, half enraged, half disbelieving.
Is that all you are? A common cad? Just what are you implying, boy?
Stop it, both of you! and then the door behind me flew open.
By God, Nix, what the hell are you doing?
I turned to meet my father's wrath and Mr. Hart's panic. The man's eyes were as round as coins on a face pale as death.
What is this?
He whispered, and his eyes lit upon the map in my hand. He rounded on Slate.
Thievery?
Blake pointed a furious finger at Kashmir.
I don't know what your game is, but... Blake, get out!
Mr. Hart shouted. Kashmir took Blake by the shoulders and pushed him out into the hall, slamming the door shut behind him. Slate's face was inches from mine.
What were you thinking?
He wasted no more time on me, though. Instead, he took the map out of my hands, and his own hands trembled to touch it. He held it so delicately, as though it was the most precious thing in the world to him, and he seemed hardly to breathe. Then Mr. Hart plucked it right out of his hands and dashed away to the fireplace.
No!
Slate reached toward him, hands high, palms out. Mr. Hart stood on the hearth, towering over the captain, his feet apart and his face a mask of wrath, a colossus of Barletta. And in that moment, I could not imagine ever seeing weakness in his maddened eyes. He raised his hand as though to strike the captain across the face, and his arm shook with the effort of holding back the blow. But then anger cooled to cruelty, and instead he dipped the map toward the flames.
Please.
Slate clasped his hands in supplication, and Mr. Hart stopped, the paper a hand span above the hungry blaze. I held my own breath to see this spectacle, to watch my father beg. Maybe it was the last map, just as my father had said. And if Mr. Hart would only lower his hand, my worries would burn with the paper into smoke and fire, heat and light.
Please believe me, Slate said, imploring. This was not my plan.
Mr. Hart did not move, and sudden rage rose in my father's eyes.
Burn the map and lose your chance of erasing your debts. Debt is the least of my worry if he catches me double-dealing.
Mr. Hart's voice was a frosty contrast to the fire.
Not a word.
Slate wrung his hands. All the fight had fled.
I won't breathe a word to him, I swear. Let me honor our agreement, please.
Mr. Hart pulled the map back slightly, but he shook his head.
You will. You will honor the original agreement of the evening. Whatever you say.
But Mr. Hart twisted as if in agony, reconsidering his own demands, weighing riches to ruin, and his own fury ebbed in the struggle. Finally, he spoke again, almost pleading.
You must understand. I cannot risk it. I do. I understand,
Slate said, his voice soft as mercy.
Yes,
Mr. Hart said, as though agreeing with him.
Yes, and not a word about our little discussion to the others, or not a word.
Mr. Hart lifted the map away from the flame, and my own wild hope turned to ashes on my tongue. Chapter 22. Mr. Hart shut the door between the study and the drawing room, and after a long silence, Slate turned to Kashmir.
Get the coach.
Without a word, Cash opened the door to the hall, where he found himself face to face with Blake. Neither spoke, but Kashmir took the opportunity to brush past him with a stiff shoulder. Blake's eyes were on me as the captain took my arm, gripping my wrist like he gripped the wheel in bad weather. But I avoided Blake's gaze. Humiliation flamed on my cheeks. Slate barged through the hall and down the stairs. I practically had to run to keep up, red petals from my lei falling in our wake. I heard the startled murmurs of the crowd, felt the stairs like spiders on my shoulders, and prayed Kashmir would be quick. My prayers were answered. As we got to the front steps, the carriage was pulling up to the drive. But Blake wasn't far behind.
Wait,
he said as Slate climbed in. Cash reached down to help me up, staring coldly at Blake all the while. "Miss Song!" But I willed myself not to react. The captain pounded on the canopy, the driver put the whip to the horses, and we rolled away, leaving Blake on the steps. We reached the road, and the captain slammed his open palm down on the velvet, his face white with rage.
"What the hell were you thinking? Did you want him to destroy the map?"
"That would solve my problems," I said, but Slate had already rounded on Kashmir.
"And you? How could you double-cross me like this? You're lucky that map is safe, or your worthless carcass might not be."
Fury boiled in my breast as Kashmir paled.
"Captain, I'm sorry. It wasn't him, Slate." "Oh, sure, I believe that," he retorted. "The professional thief had nothing to do with the heist."
"A professional thief wouldn't have botched it," I snapped back. "It was completely my idea."
"And he went along with it?"
Slate jabbed a finger into Kashmir's chest.
"You better get your loyalty straightened out quick, kid. If I didn't need you on this job, you'd be swimming to your next destination."
I stared at my father. "Slate, you can't honestly be planning to go through with the theft."
"I can do whatever I damn well choose."
"Blake knows something's up."
"Who?"
"The boy we just left on the steps. He's suspicious, and he'll report you before you can get near the treasury."
"Hart, son, why would he do that?"
"Because he doesn't want his father to destroy something important," I said pointedly. Slate's eyes widened.
"Did you tell him what was going on? Nixie!"
He took me roughly by the shoulders, his nose inches from mine.
"Did you tell him?"
"No." My voice was calm, and I did not flinch. He leaned back, eased up.
"But I should." "Don't you dare."
"Why not? I could even make the report myself. The king will arrest the Hawaiian League. The kingdom will be safe. You won't have to worry about the money, and I won't have to worry about the map." Slate raised his finger, pointing it at me in a silent accusation. Then he curled his hand into a fist and brought it to his mouth, as though to keep himself from speaking, and the hollow rhythm of the horse's hooves seemed very loud in the night. Finally he spoke, though I did not hear what he said. "What?"
"I'll teach you,"
he repeated, a hoarse whisper.
"Help me, and I'll teach you how to navigate."
I scoffed. "You're lying."
"No,"
he said quickly.
"I swear."
I looked into his eyes, and I believed him. But rather than the triumph I expected, I was filled with a cold fear, squirming in the pit of my stomach. "You must really believe this map is the one."
"I know it is."
I wet my lips. "If you're so sure, why should I risk it?"
"Is it such a risk?"
he said, his voice faltering.
"Would a life here be so terrible?"
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Kashmir turn his face. I clenched my jaw, but Slate pressed forward.
"Or the life you want, then. The escape you've got planned,"
he said desperately. My mouth fell open. I never thought he'd acknowledge it so openly. Suddenly, irrationally, I wished I'd let Joss tell me my fortune. Slate plowed on.
"Not a risk, then, Nixie. A gamble. And think of the reward."
He took my hand, and his was so hot, mine so cold, I pulled away.
"Sometimes a person has to let go of something to take hold of something else. You always have to choose what's more important."
"Oh?" I swallowed, curling my fingers on my lap, holding fistfuls of silk. "And what is more important to you, Captain? Leon or me?" He stared at me for a long time, but he didn't answer my question. Then he put his forehead against the canopy support and stared at the trees. When Slate spoke again, his voice was changed, the tone simple, the passion gone.
"I have to try, Nix. If I don't, what am I?" I love her. Do you understand? I can't just let her go. And maybe, even if it does change everything, maybe you'd be happier too. Did you ever think of that? If none of this had happened, if I'd never disappointed you, if I could do it all over again, I could have been the best father. I still could.
We rode the rest of the way to the docks in a vast and airy silence. I felt empty, my body cold and light as the night breeze, and Kashmir's face was still as stone. Once back aboard, the captain went back to his cabin and paused outside the door.
Think about it, Nixie.
Then, as though ashamed of his words, he opened the door swiftly and disappeared behind it. I gripped the rail and stared at the mountains. They were steely as knives under the moon. The sound of laughter and music still drifted from town, and it grated on my ears. Kashmir came to stand beside me, putting his hand close enough to mine that I could feel the warmth of him. I folded my arms across my chest. "What should I do?" I said softly. "I don't want to turn him in, but I don't think he'll stop otherwise."
"I don't think he'll stop either way."
Kashmir shrugged one shoulder.
"Why not help him?"
"What?"
"It's very altruistic to try to save the kingdom. But this is not a fairy tale. He's offering what you'd always wanted. Why not take it?"
"Kashmir." Did he really not understand? If the map works, and if I'd had a different life, we never would have met. You would have been cornered on that dock in Wadi Almas. He waved my words away, trying to look nonchalant. If I didn't know him so well, I might have been fooled.
"You shouldn't worry about me, Amira. You shouldn't worry at all."
"Why not?"
"Well, if we'd never met, neither you nor I would have known it could have been different. But even if the captain rewrites his own history, how could it affect your reality? I'm from a place you call a fairy tale, and I'm still here."
"But the Wadi Almas was real once. People believed in it."
"I believe in you. Simple enough, right?"
His smile was heartbreaking. I pulled the pins out of my hair, letting it fall down in coils on my shoulders. Of course it wasn't that simple, but I didn't want to argue against his point. "Why should I take the risk?"
"He'll take it for you, either way."
"You're not even angry," I said with wonder. "How can you forgive him?"
"How can you hold it against him?"
Kashmir returned. He shrugged off his jacket and folded it over his arm.
"Love makes fools of us all. He has to believe it will work, because he's in love."
He ran his hand through his hair, mussing the gel, and leaned against the railing, watching the full moon shimmer on the water.
"And I have to believe it will not."
I tried to read his face, but his eyes were a mystery. I pulled my shawl tighter around my shoulders. The silence was unbearable. "At least it seems like you had fun at the party," I said finally. He laughed a little.
"Yes, I did enjoy the dancing."
"Mrs. Hart is quite a good dancer, I hear," Kashmir scoffed.
"That woman. I've been chased by policemen with less tenacity. I tried to shake her on the lawn, but she found me coming out of the study. She very nearly dragged me into the drawing room by the collar. Thank all the gods she didn't notice I was holding the map."
"You certainly found a clever way to distract her."
"It was necessity, I assure you."
"Nix," Kashmir said, a smile creeping into his voice.
"Are you jealous?"
"No." Suddenly, the whole dock seemed very quiet, the sound of many ears listening. Unasked for and unappreciated, my brain reminded me of an Arab proverb. Jealousy is nothing but a fear of being abandoned. I lowered my voice, flustered. I'm not jealous. I just don't... I'm not jealous.
Oh, good.
Cash bit his lip, but the ghost of his smile lingered.
I'd hate for you to be a fool as well.
We stayed there a long time then, the only sound the water lapping on the pilings. Kashmir seemed to be waiting for me to say something, but I didn't. I couldn't. Finally, he took a deep breath.
Good night, Amira.
For a while after he left, my eyes wandered across the sky as though the answers were there. Then I dropped my shawl on the deck, kicked off my shoes, and gently removed the crimson lei from my neck. I hung it from the bar at the top of my hammock. Then I lay down hard. The full moon swam like its own reflection in my vision. Had I been too selfish? I had never known my mother, but I knew my life as it had been without her. The ship, the sea, the myths, the maps. And yes, Kashmir. The pain I felt at the thought of losing him, the same pain that kept me at arm's length, gave me a hint of my father's own struggle. But what if I could navigate? I could forget about my father and his search and finally be free to do and to feel whatever I wanted. And all that it would cost was a king's ransom. I buried my head in my pillow. Kashmir had been right about one thing. This wasn't a fairy tale. Chapter 23. The morning watch was mine, but I only half registered the sound of the Caladrius crowing for her biscuit, and I was definitely sleeping when Rotgut came on deck to relieve me at 8. It was a relief, too. I'd been having a nightmare, standing before a mirror, gazing into a pair of eyes that weren't brown like mine, but as black as the abyss, and they were gazing back into me. After Rotgut woke me, I fell back into a light doze, twitching at every sound. The sun pried my eyes open sometime after noon, so I rolled out of bed and put my foot on something cold and slimy. Ugh! On the deck, in the shadow of my hammock, lay a striped silver fish about the length of my hand. Its eyes were still clear, and its scales hadn't yet lost their opalescent sheen, no more than an hour old. The only marks it bore, aside from a flattened area in the shape of my heel, were twin puncture wounds right behind the eyes. Swag had left me a present. Rotgut glanced over his shoulder at the sound of my voice. He was standing on the quarterdeck, casting his bait into the blue water.
"It's you and me today," he said. "Hey, nice dress!"
I reached behind me. The huge pink bow had been crushed as I slept, and the hem was a ruin. "You and me? Double watch?" Rotgut looked embarrassed.
"The captain actually asked me to watch you. He doesn't want you leaving the ship."
I see. And what are you supposed to do if I try?
He didn't say. Just don't do it, unless you want him mad at me.
I sighed, but I hadn't been planning on leaving anyway. At least not yet. I nodded out at the ocean. Any luck?
Oh, lots,
he said, grinning. I checked the bucket beside his feet. The only thing in it was seawater.
All of it bad.
I know how that feels. Here, I said, slipping the dead fish into the pail. It's only a little mangled.
Wow, thanks.
Rotgut pulled up his line to check the bait. The hook was empty. He put on a fresh piece of squid.
I ran away from home once,
he added, almost cheerfully. What?
I suppose technically I'm still running. Since I never went back. That's why you want to learn to navigate, isn't it?
He cast his line.
So you can leave us.
I leaned on the rail. Don't try to guilt me.
I'm not.
He was quiet for a while, both of us watching the painted wooden bobber.
even though we'd never ever see you again.
I pursed my lips. You just said you've done the very same thing.
Doesn't mean I don't regret it. Of course, that's what life is, gathering regrets to mope about in your old age.
Is that what they taught you in your monastery?
Nah, I didn't learn that till after I left. Trouble is, once you leave, it's too late. You can't come back. You, particularly.
He checked his hook again. Nothing.
So I would just figure out first if you're running away or running too.
Running to what? He snorted.
I guess that's your answer.
You know, I haven't made any decisions yet, I said annoyed.
Okay. When you do, give me a chance to say goodbye before you go.
Rotgut dropped the line back into the bay. The afternoon sunlight was heavy on my shoulders, so I went below to change. The air was stuffy in my cabin, and I was grateful to swap the silk dress for my shirt and trousers. Back above, I watched the surfers out past the reefs, lithe and tan, flying effortlessly ahead of their white wakes. The sun was harsh in the sky, and it scattered on the water like shards of broken glass. Unbidden, my mind revisited the events of last night, and then skittered away from the embarrassment of it all. Then, of course, back again, like a shark to a carcass. What a mess. I pulled the pendant of my necklace back and forth on the chain, and my eyes went to the lei. It had fallen in the night, and now lay in a heap on the deck, wilted and withering. The choice before me was no clearer in the light of day. Although if Blake made good on his threat to turn us in, perhaps the choice had already been made. In a way, it would have been a relief not to have the option. And yet, I couldn't deny the temptation. In fact, it was easy to make excuses. I'd read the history. The monarchy was already in decline. Much of the island was owned by foreign interests. Even Blake had said it. The kingdom of Hawaii was already disappearing. Perhaps we were even meant to take the money. Perhaps that history had already been written somewhere. And if it was supposed to happen, who could blame me? The red flowers, sacred to Pele, lay at my feet. Creator, destroyer. I knew exactly who would blame me. And then, as though summoned, came the voice from the pier.
Miss Song?
Blake was standing at the bottom of the gangplank, holding his hat in his hands. He'd replaced the black mourning ribbon on the band with a blue that matched his eyes.
May I come aboard?
My pulse quickened, but I had to know what brought him. Back at the stern, Rotgut was still fishing. It wasn't as though I was leaving the ship. I beckoned Blake up the gangplank.
You look well,
he said to me. Did you come to check after my well-being? He pursed his lips.
After the behavior of your tutor.
I blushed. I couldn't help it. You have the wrong idea.
I know.
He ran his hands along the hat brim, smoothing the ribbon.
But what's the right one? I was convinced you were conspiring with the League, but it appears you were in fact conspiring against them. Thievery, my father said. What did you want with that old map?
I swallowed. Denying it would be foolish at this point, but I couldn't tell him the truth. At least not all of it. My father needs the map. Your father is willing to sell it if the League forgives his debts. It was his turn to blush, but he did not lower his gaze.
And what is the price?
It is quite high.
Must be to outstrip my father's debts, and every penny they get they'll use to further their goals.
He rubbed his chin with one ink-stained finger.
So you were trying to steal the map instead. I'm sorry I interfered. If I'd known, I would have helped you.
You hate your father so much? Blake hesitated.
I cannot condone his actions.
Hope rose in my throat. I took Blake's arm and pulled him close enough to whisper. You can still help. I'd be willing to pay you to—
Please, Miss Song. I would need no pay if only I could find the map. I looked this morning.
He shifted on his feet, still playing with the brim of his hat.
I have no right to ask, especially after my accusations. But if you could see your way to appeal to your father...
My laugh was bitter, and he nodded sadly.
I deserve that.
That's not it, I said. I've tried to speak to him many times, but he will not be swayed.
Blake slapped his hat against his thigh. Why on earth is that map so valuable to him? I could do one similar in half an hour.
Similar, but not the same, I said carefully. The original is a connection to my mother. It was drawn while she was still alive. He looked at me closely, his eyes the hard blue of sea ice.
Quite a lot of money to spend for something of sentimental value.
Why was he so damnably observant? I shrugged, trying to seem nonchalant. They say love makes fools of us all. His gaze was like a harpoon. I couldn't look away.
They do say that.
He was quiet for a moment as I glanced from his face to the sea, then back, and away again.
Miss Song, he said finally, there is some mystery here.
I can't think what it might be, I said breezily.
I can't either.
He cocked his head, studying me. The late afternoon sunlight shone in his hair like a crown. Suddenly he smiled.
But it's very intriguing.
I blinked.
Oh? And it has been from the very first day you arrived. Under other circumstances, Miss Song, I may have come to the ship to make a very different appeal to your father.
My eyes widened, and there was a feeling in my stomach then, like small fish leaping. These were uncharted waters, treacherous and strangely tempting. Mr. Hart. Then out of the corner of my eye, I saw a familiar pair returning to the ship. You shouldn't be here. He stiffened, chagrined.
I apologize for my boldness.
No, I mean, you really shouldn't be here. I grabbed his arm and pulled him down to crouch behind the bulwark, so Slate and Kashmir wouldn't see him. I caught Rotgut's glance. He had a hand over his mouth, and his expression was somewhere between amusement and alarm. I put my finger to my lips and a question in my eyes. He spread his hands, but he nodded once and waved us toward the hatch. Chapter 24 I took a moment to throw my silk dress over Swag's bucket before I pulled Blake into my room and shut the door.
What's happening?
Keep your voice down.
Why?
He whispered.
I don't want him to know you're here.
Who? The captain? Or Mr. Ferris?
I put my hands on my hips.
Your insinuations are not very gentlemanly.
The corner of his mouth quirked up.
Neither is your tutor.
I opened my mouth to respond, but fell silent at the sound of footsteps on the deck above and voices as they passed overhead.
Come, Captain. How and where would we find so many we could trust? Perhaps in one of these back valleys?
I cleared my throat more noisily than I had to, but thankfully their conversation faded quickly to murmurs, and for once it seemed like Blake was not listening closely. His eyes were flitting around the room, never resting long on one spot, and he shifted on his feet.
Mr. Hart, I said, crossing my arms and making a show of steadying him, this may be the first time I've seen you at a loss.
He laughed a little, but he was spinning his hat nervously in his hands. He glanced at the triangular corner of my room, the part behind the bow, which was bare but for some pillows, and the tattered quilt Slate had wrapped me in when he'd taken me from the opium den.
Is this where you live?
I shook my head. It's only where I keep my things. He stretched out his arms, standing where he was. His fingertips brushed the sides of the ship.
There isn't much space.
I have the rest of the world. He dropped his arms to his sides.
Have you ever considered a life elsewhere?
Oh, many times, I said lightly, and many places.
Spoken like a true adventurer.
Blake turned in a slow circle, and his eyes fell on my scattered books. He knelt to pick them up, but I crouched beside him, taking his hand in mine. Leave them be, I said. I'll clean later. Then I tilted my head. Are you blushing? He pulled his hand back as though stung. Then he laughed ruefully.
It appears I am not so at ease in your territory as I am in my own.
I'll keep that in mind, I said, feeling bold. The next time you try to impress me, I'll press-gang you instead. We could use an extra deckhand. He grinned.
I'd rather find a way to draw you back ashore. Tell me, Miss Song,
he said, taking my hand this time, running his thumb gently over my skin.
Have you ever considered staying in Honolulu? I promise you, on this island, you will find a lifetime of adventure without ever having to raise a sail.
I opened my mouth, partly in surprise, partly to speak, but I was interrupted by a knock at my door.
Amira?
For a moment, we were both still. The silence was stifling.
Yes? Can I... I wanted to talk to you about last night.
If I hadn't been nearly nose to nose with Blake, I wouldn't have seen it, the tightening around his eyes. I cleared my throat, trying to keep my voice light.
There's nothing to talk about, Cash.
He was quiet so long I thought maybe he'd gone.
As you say,
he said finally. I didn't hear his footsteps as he left, but I did hear his door open and close. I sighed, and Blake dropped my hands and stood, taking a step back, suddenly quite formal.
Perhaps rather than...
He cleared his throat.
Perhaps I might indeed take a moment to speak with the captain.
What for? He straightened his shoulders.
I am no scoundrel.
I pressed my lips together and took a step back myself. I don't think that's wise.
Have I flattered myself to think you've enjoyed the time we've spent? I am not asking for a promise, only an opportunity.
An opportunity. And an escape, although not the one I'd planned. I imagined it then, not just another week, but another year, another decade, a lifetime here in the place of my birth, learning more than what I could in books, in paradise before the fall. Although fall it would. Knowing what I knew, the choice should have been clearer. But looking into Blake's eyes, I couldn't find the words to give him a real answer. Instead, I resorted to cowardice. My father would likely refuse.
Perhaps he's never considered that a ship is not the best place for a lady.
I'm not a lady, Blake. I'm a sailor.
But so nearly a local. You may consider extending your stay just for a time. A year, two... We could explore the hidden trails and the secret caverns and live on fish and fruit. I could even teach you to surf if you miss the rhythm of the water.
He took my hand again and stared into my eyes. His own were the color of the open sea.
We could map every hidden spot on the island.
Blake. My mouth was dry. All I could add was... Please. He clenched his jaw, blocking all the objections he wanted to make behind his teeth. Blake was indeed a gentleman. He stood the next few minutes in excruciating silence, his hands clasped and his head bowed, before I crept out of the room to check the hall. The coast was clear, and quietly we went above. Rotgut didn't look at us, but he did raise one hand in a salute. I walked Blake to the gangplank, where he stopped. "Come, Mr. Hart," I said. He opened his mouth to speak, but he didn't say anything for a long moment. Then his eyes fell on the red lei lying on the deck, and he sighed.
"Do you know it's customary for people leaving the islands to toss leis from the boats, in the hopes that they, like the flowers, will return some day to Hawaii's shores?"
He put his hat back on his head.
"Goodbye, Miss Song. It's been quite an adventure."
I didn't want to watch him go, but it was difficult to turn away. Once he was out of sight, I picked up the lei and let it fall onto the waves, where it floated like blood in the water. Would I ever reconsider? One day might I grow old seeking a map of this place and time? The thought terrified me. I had promised myself years ago I'd never make my father's mistake. I was not meant to drop anchor or seek harbor. I went below, out of the island sun and away from the sight of the town, to hide in the bosom of ship. But she was like a sleeping beast. I didn't know whether I was safe under her protection or caught in her claws. My room felt claustrophobic when it never had before, so I made a half-hearted attempt at clearing the floor, piling my clothes against the trunk, and stacking the books Blake had so nearly taken up. Half of them had been printed in the next century, although they covered the last few millennia. The Gods of Egypt, the Prose Edda, and here Beowulf in the original Old English, the story of a hero who saved his people by killing a monster. Of course, if you consider Grendel's mother, Beowulf was the monster who murdered her son. I closed the book and placed it atop a book of fairy tales, the old ones, the grim ones, the ones without happy endings, the ones that had been real. Why did the stories I knew best never end well? And why, too, did I feel at home among them? I could never give up the myths, the maps, the ship that had shaped me. Blake's home might be paradise, but my home was the temptation. The last book in the pile wasn't a book at all, but the covers of the hymnal that protected the map Joss had sold me. I sucked in a breath. I knew then how to get my father what he needed. I took the map with me as I went above, and with a new sense of purpose, knocked on Slate's door. "Captain?" It was a moment before he responded.
"Yes?"
He was sitting cross-legged on the floor with his elbows on his knees, his palms open toward the sky, his jacket flung over the chair. By his mussed hair and flushed cheeks, he must have just lifted his head from his hands. But when he saw the look on my face, he scrambled to his feet.
"You found something."
I met his gaze. "You'll teach me?"
"Yes."
"Then this is the last map I help you with."
"I promise,"
he said quickly, but I shook my head. "I'm not asking you," I said. "I'm telling you. This is the last time." He caught his breath, then let it out, something softer than a sigh.
"I always knew you'd abandon me once you knew how."
"I'm not abandoning you," I said. "I'm letting you go."
"I don't want you to leave."
"But you want the map, and you need my help." My claim sat in the air between us, and he did not contest it. "You said it yourself, Slate. Sometimes a person has to let go of something to make room for something more important. You have to choose." He was quiet for so long, I began to fear he'd made the offer without thinking I'd accept. But as I watched, his expression cycled from sorrow to resignation, and then to something like relief.
"You're right, Nixie,"
he said at last.
"I'll let you go, too."
I bit my lip to keep it from trembling. He'd let me go a long time ago. After all, you can only hold one person tight if you're holding on with both hands.
Chapter 25. As promised, a note came from Mr. D. midweek, setting the time and the place for our next meeting. 10 p.m. at the business of our mutual friend. We arrived late at Joss's apothecary. The captain had lingered over dinner and dithered when he was dressing, and as we were leaving the ship, he stopped dead, just off the gangplank, and wouldn't move for half a minute. Then he started walking again, but slowly, and he hesitated once more on the street outside the shuttered apothecary. Slate didn't want to go in. I shared his reluctance, although my reasons were different. But we were committed to the scheme, and it was unwise to loiter outside. Although curfew was only for native citizens, we didn't want to call attention to ourselves just now. Cash pushed on the door to the Happy House. It swung open easily. A candle flame shivered in the gloom. "Come on, Captain," I said with more confidence than I felt. I took Slate's arm and pulled him along. That same peculiar odor hit my nose, of dust and leaves and bitter tinctures. But in Auntie Joss's place behind the counter, there stood a behemoth of a man, with knuckles like walnuts, and eyes as narrow and impassive as gaps in window blinds. His presence confirmed my suspicions even before I smelt the smoke. We were not meeting in an apothecary. He moved his chin almost imperceptibly toward the crooked stairs behind the piles of crates at the back of the shop. I led the way, grasping the rickety rail with one moist hand. Stepping down, I was nearly blind in the dark, following the sweet reek in the air, with my other hand in front of me. When I touched velvet fabric, I pawed at the curtains to reveal a bleary light. The room was wide, larger than the footprint of the apothecary above. The ceiling was low, and the blue smoke gathered along it like storm clouds. Some parts of the wall were plaster, some rough wood. There was a section with peeling wallpaper, as well as a portion of unfinished stone. But along all of the walls were bunks with thin mattresses, some occupied, at least physically, by dreamers. On a chair in the corner, a bored woman nude to the waist plucked the strings of a guzheng. Guided by another woman with a pocked face and downcast eyes, Auntie Joss approached. She wore a rich silk robe and carmine on her wrinkled lips, which cracked into a courtesan's smile as she greeted us.
"It's been so long, Captain," she said. "Pity your friends are waiting, or we could talk about the past."
"I have no friends here," Slate muttered.
She laughed lightly, as though he'd made a witty joke, then turned her unseeing eyes on me.
"And Nix, welcome back. If we had more time, we could talk about the future."
"Joss, didn't you know that selling opium is illegal these days? Although I suppose it's hard to make ends meet, selling our secrets." I started to follow Slate and Kashmir, who had gone with the young woman off into the smoke, but Joss grabbed my arm and leaned in close.
"Why, Nix," she said, her cloudy eyes wide. "They are not yours alone. I wasn't always blind. I used to be able to read maps, too. Perhaps another time I can tell you my own secrets. For a price."
She released my arm, but I was rooted to the floor. The temptation to ask her then and there was formidable, but I had brought nothing to barter with. I caught up to Kashmir and Slate as they reached a large rug, surrounded by piles of flat, tattered pillows, where the four members of the Hawaiian League were sitting.
"Captain, Miss Song," Mr. D said as we joined them on the floor, "and the math tutor."
His expression was careful and even.
"Or was it the dancing instructor?"
Kashmir inclined his head and gave them his charming smile. Of all the conspirators, only Mr. D seemed comfortable here. Mr. Hart was glaring at Kashmir, and Millie's legs were folded awkwardly, all angles, like a colt lying in the field. Mr. T was staring with an outraged expression at the musician's bare breasts.
"Forgive him,"
Mr. D said with a conciliatory gesture.
"We are well outside his usual social circles. It was an effort to get him to attend at all."
Mr. T turned his face, but not his eyes, toward the captain and whispered through his sneer.
"It's not your forgiveness that concerns me."
"Come now, Mr. T, we are not in church,"
Millie said.
"We are here so we may speak plainly, without fear of being overheard."
"Indeed, there is no fear of that, sir, for God himself would shun this place."
Then Mr. T drew back as a woman in an embroidered red dress brought tea, kneeling down to place the tray on the rug and pour each cup. Her fingers were stained brown. Had my own mother held me with tar-stained hands? The men were silent as she poured, and Slate in particular stared at his cup like she'd filled it with poison. Although the basement room was cool, his brow was covered with sweat. Mr. D raised his own teacup.
"A toast to the success of our venture."
The others lifted their cups, but when I reached for mine, Cash touched my arm. I started.
"Puppy tea,"
he said under his breath. I curled my fingers back into a fist. I should have guessed. Slate was still staring at his cup, and Mr. D was watching him. He must have chosen this place specifically to get to the captain, and it was working. Had Mr. Hart told Mr. D what had happened the night of the ball, or had Mr. D guessed? The smell of the tea was bitter in the back of my throat. I took Slate's cup and raised it. "Cheers," I said, before dumping it out on the rug. Mr. D's smile didn't falter, and he inclined his head.
"Let's move forward with the plan, then, Captain."
Slate blinked, and he refocused, not on the men seated across from him, but on the teapot in the center of the rug.
"Yes, the plan. Over the last few weeks, Kashmir and I have been checking out the layout of the palace and the grounds and so forth. Well, we found the treasury is guarded at all times by..."
He looked at Kashmir for confirmation.
"Four members of the Royal Hawaiian Guard?"
"Indeed," Kashmir said, taking over smoothly.
"But when the king hosts events, only the youngest guards are left at the treasury across the street. The most experienced guards are nearest the king, to impress the guests and so forth. And the rest are in the barracks on the palace grounds. So our excursion is best planned for a night when the king is throwing a party."
"Shouldn't be difficult," Millie said, laughing through his nose. "He's always throwing a party."
"Fine," Kashmir said. "Next consideration, the Honolulu Rifle Club. 32 armed men, mostly American, by all reports, excellent shots. The only force on the island aside from the Royal Hawaiian Guard, and they have better training and nicer guns. Mr. T, you have a connection there."
Mr. T's eyes widened.
"How did you learn that?"
Kashmir gave him a withering look.
"From what I've discovered of their political sympathies, it would seem an easy matter for the Honolulu Rifles to be encouraged to avoid the fray."
Mr. T paused for a moment.
"That can be arranged." "Good. I'd rather you do it than I,"
Kashmir said. His eyes flicked to me then. It was almost my turn. I sat up straighter and surreptitiously wiped my sweaty palms on the legs of my trousers.
"Next item," he went on. "The vault in the treasury holds an estimated... I know the keys to the vault are held by a Mr. Frank Pratt,"
Millie said, interrupting.
"A jumped-up little man, married, well, Mr. Franklin Seaver Pratt, the Registrar of Public Accounts,"
Kashmir said crisply.
"Recently appointed, though he served on the staff of Kamehameha V. Mr. Pratt, who resides on Bear Tanya Street with his wife, Elizabeth Kekaaniau Pratt, Mrs. Pratt, who is grandniece and blood heir of Kamehameha III. Mr. Pratt calls her Lizzie, I'm told. Yes, I'm aware of who holds the keys.
I couldn't help but stare at him, and he smiled with only his lips.
Now, I estimate the weight of the treasure at a ton and a half. Could be over two, depending on how much of it is in silver.
I must remind you, Mr. D said, our agreement regarding confidentiality is of utmost importance, should you decide to hire any ruffians to help you carry the weight. I trust this will not be a problem.
It will not, I said, hoping my voice wouldn't quaver. But then I tried not to laugh when heads whipped around, as though they'd forgotten I was there. The weight of the gold had been the easiest problem to solve. And we won't be hiring any ruffians.
You have a crew of five. How else will you manage this feat of strength, or protect yourselves from the Royal Hawaiian Guard?
Mr. D said with unconcealed interest. I met Mr. D's eyes, unwilling to even hint at the answer. Unfortunately, confidentiality is of utmost importance. His expression stayed pleasant, but barely.
Indeed.
We can deliver your payment wherever you like, but we'll need to know in advance where that is, I said, unless you're coming with us that night. Mr. D sighed.
I believe I'd prefer an evening in, but we will send one representative. We have to be sure the job is done, after all, and done correctly.
Millie had gone pale.
And how will we decide on that representative? He asked. I cannot volunteer, sir, and I hope we're not doing anything so low class as drawing straws. I will not be available that night, I assure you, Mr. T agreed. He thought for a moment. Whatever night it may be.
No, Mr. D said, but I thought Mr. Hart would like the chance.
Me?
Mr. Hart half stood, upsetting his teacup. The Guzheng music paused, and in the sudden shocked silence, the dreamers stirred in their beds. He settled back down at a gesture from Mr. D, but the furious gleam was back in his eyes.
I see, he hissed through his beard. I see how it is. The map is not enough for you. My shame is not enough for you. You would bleed me dry.
The map is a doodle on a bit of paper, Hart,
Millie said with a sneer.
Admittedly, so is a banknote, but the values are nowhere near the same.
It was valuable enough to you when you all came to me with this scheme, gentlemen,
Mr. D said, perhaps to remind them.
Mr. Hart, we need a member of our party to represent our interests, and you will do nicely. You are, after all, the bravest of our group, at least as judged by willingness to take risk.
He brought his teacup to his lips, although he only pretended to drink.
And will Mr. Hart bring the map at that time?
Slate said, his voice a touch too loud.
I think that is unwise. What if it were to be damaged in the scrum?
Mr. D asked.
We will meet again after the event, at which time we will trade the map for the location of the treasure.
What do you mean, the location?
In case there is an investigation, Captain. You cannot expect us to hide 2 tons of gold and silver in our gardens. Once the uproar dies down, we will retrieve it from its hiding place.
Slate clenched his fists.
When exactly do I get the map?
Mr. D spread his hands, palms up.
We can meet within a week, perhaps 2, longer if you are suspected of the theft. Patience is a high virtue, Captain.
Slate ground his teeth. I waited for the captain to refuse, to change his mind, but he said nothing more, so I did. We cannot accept your proposal.
Excuse me.
Nixie!
I held up my hand, silencing my father, but I kept my eyes on Mr. D. Since Mr. Hart will be coming with us for the theft, he might easily learn the location of the gold. This does not affect you. One man cannot carry it away. at least not without our special abilities, but it does